Hello and welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, Jason Rosenbaum. Chris McDaniel is on assignment. Joining me in studio today is...
Joe Manis.
And our special guest for today...
Jane Duker.
We're going to depart a little from normal political speaking trajectory. We usually have political elected officials in studio to talk to, but today we're starting a new series on Politically Speaking where we're going to talk to some of the state's most prominent and...
Behind-the-scenes player.
We're going to have Jeff Rowe on the show for next week.
Republican.
A prominent Republican consultant.
And then we have some others, but we don't want to telegraph.
So stay tuned.
We're going to keep that a secret.
Yes.
But with all of our guests, we always ask them how they got into politics, their background. Tell us your story.
Okay, so I had very little contact with politics as sort of a young child.
And you grew up here in St. Louis.
I grew up in St. Louis and born and raised here in St. Louis.
Where did you go to high school?
I went to Visitation Academy and graduated in 1984. That sounds really long ago. I mean, but anyway, I think my 30th reunion's coming up, so I've got that hanging over me. But anyway, and so I went to college at, I started at Mizzou and finished up at UMKC, so I've been all over Missouri, and then went to law school at St. Louis U. And after law school, I went to the Attorney General's office, and I was actually hired by Bill Webster, who eventually ran into trouble.
Now, that's an interesting thing. I didn't know that you worked for Bill Webster.
Yes.
Bill Webster, for our listeners, was Republican. He was considered the heir apparent to be governor in 92. He ran for governor, but ended up, it was this massive field, and he ended up losing. The person ended up being Mel Carnahan, who was governor, and Bill Webster ended up going to jail.
Correct.
So did you work with Chris Koster and Kenny Holsoff in his office, or were you in separate sectors?
No, actually, I'm probably one of the few people that crossed both of them. So General Koster was actually in the office when I started, and, you know, not long after I got there, the FBI, I happened to be on the same floor as the finance office, and the FBI came and looked at documents. I wasn't sure what I was getting myself into. I mean, I was a card-carrying Democrat and was still nonetheless hired, and I actually started with Ted Ardini, who's chief legal counsel for Governor Nixon. So we were in the same AG class. And so that was sort of interesting. We weren't sure how that was all going to play out. So we sat there and waited for the election. And then now Governor Nixon was elected. And so I primarily worked for Jay Nixon as an assistant attorney general. And frankly, that's what got me excited and into government and into politics.
It is not uncommon, especially since the AG's office is an office of, I guess, what, 200, 250 attorneys for Republicans to be hired by Democrats,
Absolutely.
Democrats to be hired by Republicans. It's
Absolutely.
More of your pedigree and what you can do for the office as opposed to
legal
political
skills.
Stuff.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
So that's kind of one of the different aspects of state government right there and there.
So. Yes, especially in the AG's office. And so what was great, though, is when Governor Nixon came in and took over, it didn't matter if you had been there for 20 years or, 5 months. If you wanted to do the work and you wanted to do big cases and do big things, you could. And so it was exciting. And so one of the first cases I worked on was the Southwestern Bell case, which was a huge, $400 million rate reduction. And I wasn't even licensed yet. And so Jay took over and I had sort of taken on the case and was sort of running with it. And it was sort of exciting. So that was the first year. That was one of his biggest cases. And I got to work on that. And that was really exciting. And I got to work with Governor Holden, who was then treasurer. So I represented the treasurer's office. So that's how I got to know Governor Holden, which is interesting.
And then you ended up.
Then I went to private practice for a while, eventually needed to make a living wage, because I waited tables at night when I was first an assistant attorney general. So
yeah, I know. Their pay is
The pay is not great. So I was really excited when then General Nixon came in and said, hey, we got an appropriation, we got some more money, and now you don't have to wait tables at night. And that was a big milestone for me. So I worked at Domenico's, for those of you who are in Jeff City. So that was sort of interesting. And so then after I did that for 2.5 years. The last case I worked on was the Kansas City desegregation case in front of the United States Supreme Court. And so John Munich in our office argued it, but there were a number of us that worked on the brief. Uh-huh. So that was exciting. And then I went to private practice, needed to make a living wage, and came home, got married, and was in private practice for a while. And then in 2002, I'd always been friends with Governor Holden, Treasurer Holden at the time. And he approached me about coming to his administration. And I happened to be 7 months pregnant. And he hired me as chief legal counsel, which is sort of an interesting timing.
I was going to say.
Oh, yeah, I had a four-year-old, and I was 7 months pregnant, and I said, okay, husband, let's go to Jeff City. So off we went and did that, and my daughter was a newborn. She was born in October, and I was chief of staff by early that spring.
So. Yeah, and you were the second woman to be chief of staff to governor. Yeah, the first was Julie Gibson. Shout out to Julie Gibson.
Shout out to Julie Gibson, and but I was the first female general counsel to a governor. Which, it, you know, the day I got appointed, I got a call from someone, and they said, "Hey, you know, are you the first female in history?" I said, "I don't know. I will have to check." And
so, so you were chief of staff in 2003, 2004.
That was a pretty combative time.
It was not. Absolutely. It was not really the best of times for then Governor Holden. What was it like to be chief of staff during a time when he was basically being battered by all sides, not only Republicans, but eventually Claire McCaskill, the auditor who eventually ran against him and beat him in a primary?
It was an amazing, looking back at the time, you know, luckily I didn't know enough. So sometimes it's better to not know enough. But the amount of transition going on, you had the House taken over finally, and the Republicans finally took over because of term limits. So you had, I don't remember, 90 something new members. So, I mean, the legislature changed instantly. So that was a dynamic that no one had ever faced before. And so, you know, that was unbelievably challenging in and of itself. And I think, frankly, it probably destabilized the political environment enough that, you know, things like primaries and crazy stuff happening and budget crisis all coming together really made for an interesting perfect storm at the time.
Yeah, because Holden had won a very tight election for governor in
20,000 votes.
Yeah, in 2000. And I'll never forget 2003, January of 2003, when the Republicans were taking over the House. They had already taken over the Senate, and there was this huge long line outside the Capitol to get through security and everything to get in for new Speaker Catherine Hanaway's address.
Correct.
I'll never forget that.
It was really amazing because I was obviously in transition from chief legal counsel to chief of staff at the time. Little did I know, you were actually, Joe, you were the first person that called me when that broke. And I was driving home from Kansas City in an ice storm with Roy Temple, who's now the chairman of the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
And, you know, I felt like I was the person who left the room and was voted, you know. And Joe called me and said, "I heard a rumor that you're going to be chief of staff." And I was like, "How does she know that?" And because I wasn't even sure that it was fully happening.
She knows everything.
No, I don't.
She clearly did at that point. And so it's.
And I've forgotten most of it.
And so, you know, I, and you were sort of the catalyst that helped me let it sink in. And I remember getting home that night and sitting up in bed wide awake saying, "This is really happening." So when a reporter asks you, I guess it's real at that point. So it was real that night. And but yeah, it was an extremely interesting time. And but I will tell you, I have still to this day have a very good relationship with Mike Gibbons. I have a very good relationship with Catherine Hanaway. And as challenging as it was, and this is what people don't remember or didn't see at the time, was how much we got done. Even though there were a lot of arguments, and there were, and they were all public. And so it was, you know, it was interesting. And so, you know, while we fought about a lot, I mean, you know, what part of no don't you understand? We vetoed the budget. I mean, there were a lot of very public battles, but there was a lot that got done. Things like, you know, tax credit reform, foster care, mental health parity. You know, we had various job bills. We had, you know, the unemployment insurance fix. Things that aren't getting done now, which is sort of interesting because I'm not sure that they were fully aware of what this transition was going to look like either. And so as much fighting as there was a lot that got done. And so behind the scenes or whatever, I mean, just or not behind the scenes, but I think people were focused because it was an election cycle on what people were fighting about. And so that was sort of interesting to do sort of the political part. But then there was just the day-to-day governing, which we did. And so people don't see that. But I don't see that sort of, I don't see that going on right now. It's a little different.
If Bob Holden would have won that primary, do you think he would have beaten Matt Blunt in 2004?
Frankly, I think he probably would have had a better chance. I think if there hadn't been a primary at all, I think he might have. I think a lot of this was a strategic political decision that was made at the time, and, you know, hindsight's always 20/20. But putting the gay marriage on the ballot during our primary was probably made it extremely challenging for us, because a lot of Republicans came into that primary, but they didn't stay with now Senator McCaskill during the general. So it was very fascinating to me to see both and how it came down. And she successfully got Republicans to come into her primary, and the gay marriage just handed it, you know, to her in that way to get those people to come in.
I mean, the gay marriage thing, just for our listeners, that was on the gay marriage ban on the 2004 August ballot. The governor put it on the August ballot. Many thought he was doing it as a help to the Democratic Party in November. John Kerry was the nominee, and to try to keep that off the radar in the November 2004. But yeah, I think it did play a major role. How big? Who knows?
Well, there were a lot of votes. I mean, and just looking at the general,
and
what she was able to keep.
From a practical standpoint, it passed with 71% of the vote, and it's a constitutional amendment. So the only way to get rid of it now is another vote, as opposed to it being a statute. So it does have actual implications.
But there wasn't big Republican issues or primaries going on at the time.
No.
So Republicans would not have come out in August, and that was a big change. So that
correct.
Was really fascinating.
Are you saying the Peter Kinder, Pat Seacrest primary was not a
It didn't seem to be top of the ticket at the time.
You might be surprised I remember that, but I actually do remember that in college.
Because I remember that. Yeah, obviously.
Governor Bob was always a team player, and me personally, I think, you know, he was doing what was better for the whole, and that was Bob's MO. And you know, sometimes politically, that doesn't always, get you where you want to be. I mean, that's my personal commentary, you know, 12 years later.
So after that, he's defeated.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's out by he was still governor, but
correct.
But in effect, by the end of 2004, he's gone. January 2005, Matt Blount comes in.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do? This is a lesson to our listeners on what happens to Big Shot.
Yeah, you wonder,
major players who lose their office.
Right. I drag my family halfway across the state, and I'm like, if my guy loses, am I done? You know, am I done in government? Am I done in politics? And, well, the first thing I did was I did help with the transition, so which was very fascinating, actually. And and I really actually enjoyed that, making sure that they had everything they needed. And, you know, there's the code. I mean, the code is government's more important than you, and the politics are the politics. But I was on the governmental side, and it was about making sure the train ran on time and government did what it was supposed to be doing. And so I did the transition, and then I came back to private practice. I was at Stinson at the time and came back to Stinson and decided, you know, I wanted to transform my practice. I had sort of grown up as a traditional litigator, a traditional lawyer, tried cases, but always loved the government, but, you know, was a litigator. But after coming back and after having worked in Holden's office, I realized that I wanted to solve problems. I didn't want to necessarily fight about them. And after, you know, administering a $25 million budget and 20 state agency and 65,000 state employees, you know, you feel, you know, you're in the position of a CEO, and you realize that, you know, litigation, and there are a lot of different ways to solve a problem. And I learned a lot of skills in private practice and then in two tours of, you know, duty in Jeff City about, how to get things done as opposed to how to blow things up and how to, you know, fight about them. And so I decided to transition my practice into more of what we call governmental solutions practice, where you have clients, individuals, and anybody that has an issue with government, you consult with them about how to solve the problem. And the beauty of all the experience that I've had has helped me, because it gives me a lot of tools to solve a problem. I don't go in now as a traditional lawyer and say, I'll sue them, you know, because that's often what lawyers do. But, you know, it's where law, policy, lobbying, coalition building, and PR and media all sort of intersect. And I did that, and that was my job, and I loved it. And I didn't realize as a lawyer that would be a skill set that I would have, because delegation is not always a lawyer's strong suit. We're type A by nature.
So tell me kind of what you do now. I know you've been obviously involved in a lot of litigation involving St. Louis County, the trash case,
the mediation, foreclosure
mm-hmm. mediation.
The Peabody case in the city.
The initiative petition in the city regarding the Moore petition. And so that, and I've done a lot of initiative petition sort of litigation work, and that's part of what I do. And mm-hmm. and that's one of the legal tools you have. And so when somebody comes to me with a problem, either a company or an individual or a group of people, a group of citizens, when I worked with the citizens in Ellisville, and, and fighting the Walmart out there, that was a lot of different skills. That had a lawsuit component, but there was also, appearing at meetings. There was also dealing with the press. There was also, different ways to skin the cat. And so what I can go to people and say is, look, you have a problem that needs to be solved. And, I have a lot of tools in my tool belt that can help you solve this problem. And so I'm sort of fortunate because I have a lawyer. A lot of consultants aren't, or a lot of people are just straight lobbyists. And I can lobby, and I've done that. I worked on the Doe Run override.
Yeah. Yes.
And so, I can do that. But I can also put the whole strategy together. And even if I'm not the entire person executing, I know all the components that need to be there to get whatever change you need, whether it be a statute change, whether it be a regulation change, whether it be you develop a coalition of people, of interested people that can help you get it done. I understand enough about policy to help people wade through and figure out which policies and where you go. And so it's more of a procedural skill as opposed to the substantive skill. I mean, I know a lot about government, but not to the extent my clients would know. But what I can do is look at them and say, okay, these are the tools you need. And this is how you deploy them and when you deploy them. And that, I think, is where, from my perspective, that what I do is unique, because I can deploy any of those tools, but knowing when to use which one to get the result you need. And so it's more of a procedural type of consulting skill. Some clients have PR departments, and so you just, you steer them. Or sometimes, they're already in a coalition, and so they already have all the interest groups that are aligned with them sort of lined up, but they need to know, how to deploy that and what to do in order to effectuate change. And so, you work within what the client has and try to help them supplement what they need to get from point A to point B. So I like the solution part of it as opposed to just the fighting part of it. Sometimes there's 10 ways to skin the cat, and why not figure out the best way to do it? And so I think being a lawyer in private practice and going back and forth twice to government has not only made me a better lawyer, it's made me a better human being, which is probably the most important thing, but it's giving me a lot of different perspectives. A lot of people in government have never been in the private world. And a lot of people who've been in the private world haven't been in government. And somebody needs to translate. And it's, and so doing both helps me translate.
Now you're, okay, and I don't want this to sound wrong, no. But in some ways you're an odd duck. In that even though you're active in Democratic politics to some mm-hmm. degree, mm-hmm. many of your clients are not like the traditional Democratic clients.
Correct.
And right. sometimes you've been on the side opposing.
Absolutely.
For example, the foreclosure mediation situation
Correct.
Were major, major priorities of not only St. Louis County Executive Charlie Dooley, but also Mayor Francis
Slay.
And you represented the other side.
I represented the Missouri Bankers Association, which is not traditionally a Democratic organization.
Although I talked about this incessantly last year, there was foreclosure mediation ordinances passed in the county and the city.
Correct.
You sued to try to get them overturned on various different grounds.
On behalf of her clients.
Correct.
Emphasize. And Correct. Then in the Peabody case, mm-hmm. you were, there's a group that collected stuff to get on the ballot that mm-hmm. would in effect block any tax breaks to Peabody or any of the people.
What they deemed an unsustainable
energy
producer.
Any businesses who worked with Peabody without getting into the details. But you represented Peabody and
I represented some citizens
right.
in the city of St. Louis who wanted to challenge that.
In the successful effort to keep that initiative off the ballot.
And I think in both of those instances, the legislature essentially passed some sort of bill that essentially short-circuited both of those things. It's definitely the
Absolutely.
Foreclosure mediation
yep.
situation. And
yep.
But I think also there's a bill pending now that would effectively make the initiative moot. Is that – am I misinterpreting that?
There's a bill that refers to it, but it's already – both ordinances have been basically declared invalid.
Mm-hmm.
But aren't being enforced at the current moment. We actually just argued in front of the Missouri Supreme Court on the county case. So weeks ago.
On the foreclosure case?
On the foreclosure case.
Okay.
And so
– news?
Which is interesting.
What's
yes.
their left to deal with in that
situation?
Well,
the whole issue of mootness and whether the county is going to try to continue to enforce it based on another reason. And it's a long, that's a procedural nightmare as to why
because,
we're up there
now. I've read that law 60 times, and it's pretty clear that that pretty much bans foreclosure mediation. I mean, even the proponents of it say so. So
they did, but the county has sort of may have changed its mind.
Anyways.
Yeah, in another way. And now you also represented one of the people in Ellisville who were against
Walmart. The Walmart. I represented Tom DeBold, and that actually went up to the Missouri Supreme Court as well, and trying to... we fought over the permit, the conditional use permit that was given to Walmart in Sansone to build a Walmart near Clarkson and Manchester Roads out
in
West County.
And in effect, that Walmart proposal is now dead, correct?
Yes, it is. Okay.
And that was the catalyst behind the wackiest municipal situation
the impeachment?
Of the last 20 years.
Yes.
That's hyperbole.
Absolutely. I mean, I was right in the middle
of
that.
Life.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah, we all spent a lot of time together out at in Ellisville at night. So I was happy to have night duty
anymore. I don't
know
if Adam Paul realizes how...
extraordinary.
I was going to say how dull this county council is compared to the Ellisville one, but after last week's meeting, I'm not sure that
you're not
stands
positive.
Anymore.
Exactly.
And then you represented some of the trash haulers, correct?
Absolutely.
Who were opposing the county's
monopoly trash program?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, to neutralize that, the county's requirement that they had to bid.
Oh, they don't dispute
segments.
That it's monopoly. They just think they can do that. And that's I mean, the issue in that case now basically is we're just arguing over how much money.
How much money the county's going to pay?
Correct. It was 1 point something million. Now we're up at 6 million, and then they're appealing again, and so the number could go up again.
So the bottom line is that
I have varying
topics.
Clients. And the good thing is too, and I think one of the reasons that works. And I think it goes toward, when you talk to political consultants. And I am a little strange because I have that whole law piece that does make it a little bit different. But, people who know me and have worked with me, Republicans, Democrats, and I get along with both, believe it or not. And, say what you mean what you say. Missouri is a small town city. St. Louis is a small town city in a lot of ways. And so, I think... one of the things that helps me be successful, both legislative arena or in the legal arena, is, you just really need to be an honest broker. And so I think people know that if, I say A, I mean A. And I think that's everything. And now with term limits and other things, lobbyists and people like me who have the history, probably more history than a lot of our legislators have, And you talk to people. I mean, if you don't tell them honestly and truthfully and where you are and why, you're not going to be working very long.
Now, are you working for Steve Stenger? Or are you just a consultant or just a supporter?
Well,
without getting into the whole county executive
the merits
race,
of it. No.
You are involved in
it. Yeah, I am heavily involved. I'm a huge supporter. I'm not paid, never have been paid.
Okay.
But I'm a huge supporter. I consult with the campaign. Whatever they need from me, I offer. And so, that's more of a... that's not as much part of my job as it is that's something that's important to me.
Well, why is that important to you? Why would you feel like it's worth exerting your energy to get involved in that race?
Well, I mean, interestingly enough, I think it sort of started with the trash case. I supported Charlie Dooley when Buzz Westfall passed away. The Democratic Party, it was a very challenging time.
Yes,
I mean, it was awful time. And Buzz was a huge supporter of Bob Holden. And some people wonder... what if he had been alive, whether things might have been a little different because, Buzz was so popular and was so
Buzz
supportive.
Buzz died in October of 2003.
Right before. Yeah. So, that was very challenging. And so, but having been in the middle of a primary at the time, the idea that anybody would put a primary up against Charlie Dooley was something that we were not supportive of.
And I think there was technically a primary, but none of the opponents were particularly strong, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I mean, it was basically cleared for him.
But continue.
And so I was supportive of Charlie. I mean, I really was, lock, stock, and barrel. And after I got back from Jeff City and Charlie won, I met with him and, offered to help. And, he was new and, I said, whatever you need. And so, but as time went on, the trash case sort of started it. I just started to see that things just, from a governmental standpoint, and at heart, I'm a governmental geek, and I believe in government. I believe if it's done well, government can be a very positive force. And I just felt that government was being twisted. And it wasn't a partisan issue, obviously, because I'm a Democrat and I'm a card-carrying Democrat and I'm open about it and everybody knows where I stand and I'm a loyal Democrat. But I just felt like government was getting twisted. And it really bothered me. And, you know, it took me a little while to come out publicly, but, you know, I've never been known to be reticent. So, you know, so I've probably been an outspoken critic for a while now. And so this isn't new that I would be supporting Steve. And frankly, Bill Corrigan, you know, didn't get it done. And I think, frankly, because St. Louis is a Democratic county, the only way that there's going to be change in that office is to do it through a primary.
Now, you had been approached to actually be chair of the Missouri Democratic Party, correct?
Well, there were discussions about a lot of different, you know, okay. people and whatnot. And so, you know, my belief on that would be, I mean, Roy is great at it.
Roy Temple.
Yes. So far, and I worked with Roy when I was in Governor Holden's office and, you know, I'm a big believer in put people where their skill sets lie and you will get the most out of them. Mm-hmm. And frankly, that's not necessarily my skill set. And so I'm extremely supportive of Roy. I'm extremely supportive of Crystal. I am so proud of what Senator McCaskill and what Attorney General Castor are doing for the party and starting to rebuild it in a way that we haven't seen since Bob Holden was around.
Is it kind of odd having somebody who had been a Republican?
Mm-hmm.
I wrote about this on the site, so for listeners who are interested. But now he's like the largest donor to the Missouri Democratic
yep.
Party. And Saturday night at Jefferson Jackson Days, it was to some degree, as someone described to me, they said, well, this is sort of the Chris Koster show. From a standpoint, I don't mean this badly.
I think it's a great thing. Yeah.
But he's
emerging
general,
as the leader.
He's the heir apparent for running for the gubernatorial nomination. You know, there's going to be a Republican challenger, so it doesn't mean there's no automatic election. But the point being that he is sort of now, in effect, the
head of the party,
the head of the Missouri Democratic
state.
Party.
And
is
it's
that
great.
An odd situation since you know
him? Well, it's interesting because I've known Chris since we were teenagers. I was actually, this is so funny, I was his bus girl when we were teenagers. He was a waiter and I was a bus girl at Pasta House in Frontenac. Again, relating to the fact that St. Louis
Hot
is
news.
a small town city. Oh, he loves to tell people. Make no mistake, he gets really excited to tell you, oh, Jane Duker was my bus girl. And we were at an event with, you know, 800 people and he told everyone that. And I was like, okay, that cat's out of the bag. So anyway, so I've known Chris for, you know, a big portion of my life. And I was fortunately, you know, one of the people that sort of knew that he was going to come over to the Democratic side. And I was, you know, I was actually thrilled about it because, you know, if you can attract people to come to your party, that's winning. You know, in my view that, you know, the Democrats, we were having a rough time at the time. And, you know, and the idea that we would be able to pick off a high profile Republican means we're winning. But I will tell you that was not met with uniform joy among people.
That was a very ugly primary between Margaret Donnelly and
Jeff Harris
and the Molly Williams. We can't forget her.
From Kansas City. Correct.
The mystery woman.
And so, you know, I mean, I was called a traitor to my gender, literally, at the time.
Oh, and I know people who supported Koster, be it Jeff Smith, Victor Callahan, Tim Green, mm-hmm. Rodney Hubbard, all those people were pillar
we were,
for
yeah,
supporting
we were not
him.
Treated. We were not treated well for a while.
Which is why I think the fact that he's become the undisputed gubernatorial nominee is kind of interesting, because the people that supported him in 2008 were kind of seen as outliers, while all these other people were supporting the other two candidates, and it's completely changed around.
Well, and it just goes to show how things can change so quickly.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, that General Koster has done a really good job of stepping up for Democrats, and that's when we need it. And the fact that you have, you know, two very strong, you know, politicians in Missouri, Claire McCaskill and Chris Koster, coming together saying, look, this is the good of the whole, and we've got to do things differently. And I think it's really impressive. I think it is very helpful for that sort of, you know, other than the primary going on in St. Louis County, you know, the Democrats are going to be united, and that's a great thing. And so he's really earned it. and it wasn't easy, yeah. and it could have easily not happened.
I do have one question about mm-hmm. that donation, though. And, I mean, obviously from a political standpoint, I don't really see much downside for either him or the party of getting that influx of money. But
absolutely.
At the same time, the party has been very adamant about campaign finance reform and campaign mm-hmm. finance limits and banning committee-to-committee transfers. That's been a big pet project of Jason Kander.
But the Secretary
do you think
of
it's
State,
inconsistent?
Do you think that's do you think the fact that, you know, the leader of the party is giving a committee to committee donation of that large amount, is that kind of undercutting that message of campaign finance reform a little bit?
I don't think it does, because this is the deal. If General Koster sat at the Democratic Party and made phone calls, he would raise money for the Democratic Party. I mean, Bob Holden used to do that when campaign finance right. limits were in place. And he would go over and he was the last one who really dedicated a lot of time, energy, and resources to the party. But with campaign finance limits, that was a little bit more necessary.
Yes.
But so it would be no different than if he sat down and raised the money, because the head of the party is usually the one mm-hmm. that does that. And so from my perspective, the committee transfer, to me is that's a logistical thing. But the bottom line is he would be raising that money for the party anyway.
I don't think it's inconsistent of him, because he's been on record twice now through his votes of not being for campaign finance limits, both in 2006 and 2008. I think he's been eminently consistent on
right.
this issue.
And so to me, though, I mean, you know, that he's just doing directly what he could otherwise do indirectly.
Right.
I mean, unless you're really going to get at that issue, you're going to have to go after committee to committee transfers, and nobody's showing any desire to get that done.
So, but I mean, from a political standpoint, it garners him a lot of goodwill.
$100,000
will help people like Jill Shoup.
And this is his second $100,000.
Yeah,
it'll help people like Jill Shoup and Jeff Roeder, who are trying to win Senate seats, and House members who are
yep.
winning tough races. So politically, I see no downside for either him
absolutely.
Or the Democrats.
And
for
I think there are a lot of a good number of Democrats out there that think that maybe that sort of influx of cash earlier on might have been more helpful for candidates. And so, it's always, again, hindsight's 20/20. But, Democrats don't want to be looking at themselves and saying, wow, if we had just, $5,000 more in this, one House race,
right.
could have made that difference. Nobody wants to look back and say we didn't do what we could have done to get it done.
Because if you look at the Republican side, I mean, they are just, as far as a legislative money train, it's just almost endless.
Oh, it's prolific.
Because
right.
not only do you have a lot of donors giving to Republican legislative candidates, because, the majority party typically gets more money because
absolutely.
That's just the nature
that's
of
how it.
It
works.
There's just a lot of senators who have large war chests who are not running for anything that could just give $100,000 to majority
whomever.
Funding or whoever wins the 24th district race or Paul Weiland or anybody else. So.
Mm-hmm.
It really does require people like Koster and potentially McCaskill and others to step up and
mm-hmm.
give that money. Otherwise, the Democrats are going to be at a huge disadvantage.
Although I was thinking about this. I mean, Koster is also raising money to run for governor.
Yes.
I mean,
and doing quite well.
And giving $200,000 within the past year to the state Democratic Party is $200,000 that's not on his bottom line.
Correct.
Although I think he can probably get $200,000 pretty quickly.
Yeah, he's shown to be very skilled at raising the money.
But my point is,
yeah.
He could have easily said no.
Governors are gubernatorial candidates,
yeah.
and I want to emphasize, I'm not knocking Governor Nixon, but Nixon took a different approach.
Right, different style.
And most of the money, like for the 2012 election, went into his coffers, and then he decided whether or not any went out to the state party or whatever, as opposed to going to the state
party. And that's garnered a lot of criticism, but I could kind of see it from his perspective, too, because number one, he was running for re-election himself.
Right. And it mattered that he was governor to Democrats.
And he was running against a millionaire.
And he was running against somebody who could drop $10 million
Absolutely.
At any time.
And the fact that, the coattails, there's something to be said for having long coattails. And so, doing really well in the governor's race, presumably gives coattails that floats all the way down. So it's a different philosophy. I think I agree with you. There may be different times and different strategies for different times. And I think that Chris, and Claire, I think rightfully say, okay, we want to do it a little differently this time. I think it'll be very interesting to see how it works out. And I think, the party, I'm very heartened by the fact that the party is not just a money laundering machine anymore. I mean, we are actively recruiting candidates out there, actually developing the messages and really, keep talking to Democrats and uniting Democrats in a way that we hadn't done in a while. And, you know, it's easier to raise money now. I mean, you know, Bob Holden did it, you know, $1,000 at a time. Mm-hmm. I mean, the number of donors that people had to get back then to get the same amount of money. I mean, Bob raised, what, $13 million for the primary against Senator McClellan? That's a lot of money, $1,000 at a time. And so, you know, it's pretty interesting how that whole strategy has changed now. And so the bigger checks, you know, make it possible quicker. And so you got, you know, politicos have reacted to that, you know, reality.
What do you see as your role, though, going forward? I mean, we're going to have the election this fall. Mm-hmm. I mean, just in general, what do you see as the climate? And then, of course, will you be active for particular clients in 2016 who are on the ballot? Or do you expect to spend time like you have been working for particular
candidates
or particular non-candidates, like I said, you know, like
issues.
Peabody or whoever?
Well, I mean, I don't much see, at least in the short term, you know, my practice changing. I mean, so I will continue to do what I do now, which is, you know, I just always call it, I'm just sort of a fixer. So you bring it to me and I'm going to find you 8 different ways to fix this problem. And I really enjoy that. And you got to love what you do to do this stuff because it's crazy. And so I don't see that changing anytime soon. I like to solve problems. I do foresee me getting more involved in sort of candidate elections. I mean, it matters.
Okay.
I will be hugely supportive of Chris Koster. I'll be supportive of our ticket and whoever that ends up being, Jason and others. And so I will be very supportive of our ticket. And, you know, and obviously I'll be involved in St. Louis County until that election is over.
Well, who's going to be AG? Would you run for AG?
No.
That's... Do you ever plan on running for office yourself?
I would be shocked if I ever came to that decision. So, yeah, I don't see it. I mean, I really like what I do. I like, you know, I like being sort of the strategist behind the scenes. I like, you know, because being the candidate is really hard. And the one thing that I learned when I was chief of staff is, you know, I mean, you're basically running government, and somebody needs to do that. And I'm very committed to government. And so, you know, I've always liked that portion of it. Being a candidate is, again, a very specific skill set. And some people are better at that than others. And so I think I'm better as a back sort of operative. I like being an operative.
Well, that should just about do it for this week's show. To close us out, you can follow all of our stories at stlpublicradio.org. You can follow Joe on Twitter at
JManis, that's JManNIES.
You can follow me on Twitter at JRosenbaum, and you can follow the prolific tweeter, Jane Duker, at
Jane Duker, JaneDuker.
Yeah, and she's definitely prolific.
I do go on rages.
Very pithy.
Prolific is an understatement.
Thank you.
We'll be back next week. Until then, so long.